So let's start with our motivation. So as we study this topic of karma, it's very important that we apply it to our lives and think of our own actions, if they're heavy, if they're light, if they're accumulated and done or not accumulated and done, if they will definitely bring all four results or not definitely. So there's a lot to think about in this topic of karma that can really affect our choices and decisions. So quite important to think about it and apply it to our lives and apply it to what we see in the world around us. So the topic of karma and its effects is not an evident phenomena that we can know with our senses. Some aspects of it, it seems that we can know by inference, by the power of the fact. But some of it we have to know by inference through authoritative testimony, through trusting scriptures that were spoken by credible people that are not contradictory within themselves. So we have to examine closely and study well and figure out what scriptural statements are reliable and what aren't, because our knowledge of karma depends on that. It's not simply a thing of believing it because somebody else said so. So while we have this human intelligence, let's use it wisely. Let's use it with kindness so that we can gain reliable cognizers that will help us on the path to awakening. And again, let's do this not for simply our own benefit, but to alleviate the misery of all living beings once and for all by guiding them to full awakening. So let's have that be our motivation this evening. Okay, so while karma is a topic that we can't know through our senses, that we can't, for all the details of it, we can't know through regular reasoning. So it's important to, for a lot of it, we have to trust scripture. Yeah, but we shouldn't just trust any old scripture or any old thing that's said, because sometimes the way things are presented, for example, different religions may have different ideas about karma that are not the same as, you know, the Buddha's notions about karma. And also, even within Buddhism, sometimes depending on the audience somebody is teaching, karma may be presented in a very simplistic manner, you know, like you hit somebody in the leg last life, so this life you're going to be born with a weak leg, you know, something like that, which, you know, and the ripening of karma is much more complicated than all of that. So, we need to take that into consideration. And then also to see the scripture, you know, who taught it, one that was taught by the Buddha, you know, passed down by a lineage of reliable people who meditated on it. Is it self-contradictory, you know, within it? Is, you know, all these kinds of things we have to test. If, you know, does the scripture say wrong things about evident phenomena? Does it say things are truly existent, you know, so about slightly obscure phenomena, it's incorrect. So we have to, you know, check it out and not just believe any scripture. But on the other hand, we can't go to the other extreme and say, well, because I can't see it and I can't use regular reasoning through it, therefore I don't believe it. You know, because if we think like that, then we're cutting ourselves off from a reliable source of knowledge that can really help us, you know, because understanding of how karma works is really critical to practicing the path. Okay, so we need to have some kind of balance in terms of that. Okay, so I thought I was going to finish karma tonight, but when I looked at how much more we have to go, I thought, no, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. So we'll get as far as we can. So one topic that I wanted to talk about is what's called natural and prescribed actions, okay? Or naturally non-virtuous and prescribed actions, okay? So there's two kind of actions to abandon. One are ones that are naturally non-virtuous, like the 10 paths of non-virtue. Yeah, and naturally non-virtuous means that any ordinary person who does those is, you know, 99.9% going to have an afflicted motivation, okay, if they have an intention. If they don't have an intention, you know, and it's done accidentally, it's a difficult thing, you know, situation. But in general, you know, those are the things that anybody who does them, like killing, you know, any ordinary person who kills, it's done with a negative motivation. Same with stealing, unwise and unkind sexual behavior, and so forth. Yeah, so negative motivation could mean attachment, anger, jealousy, pride, or ignorance about, you know, what is virtuous, what is non-virtuous, what to practice and what to abandon. So there's those to abandon. Then there's called what's called prescribed actions. And so for those of us who have precepts, the Buddha prescribed certain actions. In other words, he said, don't do these. Okay? So if we, here we, again, we have two things, naturally negative and prescribed. So let's do the 4 points with them, okay? So what is an action that would be both naturally negative and prescribed, let's, you know, by our pratimoksha precepts? What's an example? Yeah, okay. So a person with precepts, stealing, okay? Not a person without precepts. Is it a prescribed action? Well, it is kind of, because the Buddha said in terms of, you know, the non-virtues not to do it. But in terms of breaking a precept, no. Okay. Then what's an example of something that's naturally negative but not prescribed? Is there such a thing? Yeah, yeah, it seems that it would be difficult to find something that's naturally negative. Yeah, that the Buddha didn't prescribe in one way or another. Yeah, okay. Now, what about something that is not naturally negative but is prescribed? Yeah, like drinking alcohol, eating in the evening, singing, dancing, playing music, using perfumes, ornaments, and those things, okay? Which means that they aren't naturally negative, so people who don't have precepts don't accumulate non-virtue, you know, non-virtuous karma by doing them. If they do them just with a neutral mind, yeah? But monastics who do them, or people who hold the eight precepts, or, you know, who do them, then they, you know, accumulate this, the prescribed action, what's called an offense. That's what we translate as offense. The Tibetans sometimes call it, translate it as downfall, tumwa. Yeah? So you accumulate that. But, yeah, even if it's not naturally negative, and it is prescribed by the Buddha, prescribed, not prescribed, prescribed, yeah, if we do that action with a bad motivation, then we do accumulate negativity from it, okay? So, for example, if we eat in the evening with a lot of greed, it's the offense of breaking the precept, but by eating with greed, we're creating negativity. If we eat without greed, there's none of the negativity, but there's still the offense of transgressing the precept. Okay? And then what's an action that is neither naturally negative nor prescribed by the Buddha?
Sleeping.
Sleeping with a neutral motivation at the right time. Yeah, maybe sweeping the floor. How about, okay, with a neutral motivation. So you always have to qualify these things.
So a positive motivation also could be not prescribed and not natural.
Yeah, right. Yeah, if you're practicing thought training while you're sweeping the floor, then that's also not prescribed and not natural and negative. Okay, so there's different ways of purifying the negativity versus the offense. So the negativity has to get purified, because that's the negative karma, by like Vajrasattva, the 35 Buddha practice, something with the four opponent powers. The Sanskrit term for negativity is papa. Yeah, papam. So, you know, when we do the Vajra,
the Dorje Kadro,
you know, and there's the word papam in it, you know, it's burning up the negativities, okay? That's what it is. Then then to purify the prescribed actions, then for the Sangha members, you have to go to Posada. You have to attend Posada, okay? And so that's the reason, you know, why before we do Posada, we have to confess everything, so that when we actually do the Posada itself, it acts as a way of restoring the precepts and purifying that offense. Yeah. Now, according to different categories of precepts, there may be different ways that you have to, different things you may have to do to overcome the offense. Yeah. So, for example, if it's a remainder, a Sangha Visesa, then you know, you have to do penance for some time, sitting at the back of the Sangha, serving the rest of the Sangha, giving up your 35 privileges of being fully ordained, and then you have to have a process of rehabilitation with the Sangha, okay? Which is very complicated, so you don't want to commit these very often because it's very complicated to do the rehabilitation. Well, that's not the only reason not to do them. But, you know. Okay. But for things like the forfeiture lapses, then what you have to do is relinquish the object and then, you know, and confess it to the community, and then you get it back again. If it's a regular lapse, you confess it to another person who hasn't committed that particular lapse in the last 2 weeks. If it's one of the training rules, then those you can self-confess or tell to another person. So there's different ways, according to the gravity of the offense, that we have to do to, you know, to make up for, or to make amends, that's a better word, to make amends for the transgression. And then after that, to attend the sojung. Okay, or the posada. Yeah, so this is something important for the monastics to be aware of, and also the lay people who have five precepts. Because if you go, you know, if you can't counter, if you create an offense with your five precepts, then, you know, if it's naturally negative, you have to purify. If it's not, you know, you still have to confess it and restore it. Okay? So, anything on that before we go on to the next topic? Yeah.
So you're saying it's not naturally negative to break a vow?
Some precepts are naturally negative. If you kill, steal, you know, those ones, those actions are naturally negative, and you're creating an offense because you're doing something prescribed by the Buddha.
Right, but if it's not naturally negative, isn't it still negative just to breach your vow?
It's they don't call it negative. They call it something else. Okay? It's let's see if I can find what's the name. Okay, so the virtue or non-virtues, the Sanskrit is kusala or akusala. And the other one, yeah, is papa. Negativity is papa, or Tibetan is digpa. Yeah, you hear that a lot. And then the one for the offense or downfall, the Sanskrit is apati, and the Tibetan is tungwa. Okay, so it's just called offense. Yeah, they don't. When you transgress a precept that is naturally negative, your offense and the natural negativity, they're one nature but nominally different. So you have to purify them in different ways. Okay? Yeah. So you create an offense when you break a precept. Yeah. Whether it's a negativity, a non-virtue, depends on whether it's a naturally negative action. Okay? That doesn't mean it's okay to break precepts and that there's no detrimental result to it. It doesn't mean that. Yeah. Okay? It's just called by a different name. Yeah?
If you don't hold a precept and it's not naturally negative, but you have a negative motivation.
Yeah, like you want to get drunk just because, you know, you're full of attachment. Then you're creating negative karma, even though the action itself isn't naturally negative.
Because of the negative
motivation. Right. So that's why I was saying, and then if you have if it's prescribed, if you have just a neutral motivation, there's no negativity. But if you have a bad motivation, then there is negativity. Okay?
Like if you were dismissive of the precept.
Yeah. Yeah. And you say, oh, who needs to keep these precepts? Who cares about them? Doesn't matter. You know? In fact, within our precepts, it's a transgression to say, we have these silly precepts, or I never heard this precept before, even though you've been to posada many times, or, you know, I'm going to ask somebody else about this precept. I don't think this is really right when you know it is. Yeah. Okay. Should we go on to the next thing? So next we'll go back to looking at the Gongchen Lamrim. Okay. Because we need to read through the English to get the lung for it. So,
I did have a question.
Yeah.
So, breaking a celibacy vow would be the prescribed.
It'd be prescribed, and it would be naturally negative as well.
Oh, okay. What if, like, you hold different precepts and you contradict each other? Like the bodhisattva's precepts.
Okay. There, the thing is, if you have bodhisattva precepts, they're considered subtler or more sophisticated, because the pratimoksha precepts govern our physical and verbal actions, and bodhisattva precepts also govern some mental actions. And the idea is, if in order to keep a bodhisattva precept, if you have the bodhicitta motivation, yeah, then to keep that, it's permissible not to literally keep the pratimoksha precept, okay? But you have to be extremely careful with this, otherwise people use it as a rationalization to not keep their pratimoksha precepts, yeah, by saying, well, I'm practicing the bodhisattva path, and so, you know, these pratimoksha precepts are like trivial. If you think like that, that's actually a root transgression of your pratimoksha, of your bodhisattva precepts. Okay?
So, like the example of the sea captain who killed one person.
Yes. So, that person, first of all, was a bodhisattva. Second of all, that person had compassion not only for the people who would be killed, but also for the potential killer. And that person was willing to go to the hell realms. You know, they had so much compassion that if it meant they were going to go to the hell realms by killing that person to prevent the death of the others, that person, the sea captain, was willing to do that. Yeah. Now it's interesting. There's two versions of this. Some people say it's still naturally negative, but the person experiences suffering for a flash, you know, and then the negativity is over because of the power of their bodhicitta. And other people say that it's not naturally negative at all, and the person doesn't experience even a moment of suffering as the result of doing it. Okay. Now that thing is given as an example, and it's talked about all over, and then we say, well, you know, out of compassion, I don't feel like, you know, doing X, Y, and Z. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, or, you know, we make up all these excuses for our negativities by saying, well, I'm doing it out of compassion. And if you do that, then you transgress your bodhisattva precept as well as your pratimoksha precept. Okay, so we have to be quite careful about this. Yeah, it's not a license to just kind of say, I'm doing it out of compassion, so therefore I can do anything I want. Yeah. Okay.
Before we go on, if we go back to that possibilities question.
Pardon?
The four possibilities.
Yeah.
Was there one that we couldn't find?
Something that is naturally negative but not proscribed by the Buddha. Just in general, yeah. That would, I don't think. When you do the four things, sometimes you come up with one of the things and there's no examples for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very helpful to go through those four and, you know, it helps you get clear on those things. Also, you'll see that I'm using the word precept instead of vow. This came up at one of our Western Buddhist monastic gatherings, yeah? Because the word vow in English is a very heavy word, you know? It's like you vow not to do it and you're going to hell if you do it. You know, there's a lot of heaviness to the word vow. And Bhikkhu Bodhi was explaining that, it, you know, in terms of our Pratimoksha precepts, and I believe with all the precepts, they're all trainings, you know. They're trainings that we're trying to train our mind in. And so it's much better, I think, psychologically, to look at these things as trainings rather than as vows. Yeah. You still, of course, want to train it, your mind in them. You don't want to contradict them. But to avoid this kind of, you know, heaviness of saying, I promise never, ever, ever to do this, you know, with the threat of going to hell. Now, of course, so you could say, well, then what about the parajika, the defeats? You know, the thing is there, if we commit a defeat, a parajika, we've chosen to do that action. We know what the consequence of it is. Yeah, nobody's sending us to hell, you know, and the Sangha is not kicking us out. We are distancing ourselves from the Sangha community. Okay? So it's better to say that. So that's why I prefer to call them ethical restraints, or, you know, it's an ethical code rather than a vow. You know, vow doesn't, you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi was really saying it's not a good translation for the Tibetan word. And I searched high and low and talked to all sorts of people who knew Sanskrit and Pali, and the best I could come up with was ethical restraint or ethical code, you know, ethical code for a set of precepts, you know. Some people use the word vow for individual precepts. Some people use the word vow to mean the whole ordination, like you've taken the vow of a bhikshu or a bhikshuni, meaning you have all that whole set of precepts. So it's a very kind of confusing word. Hmm? And I myself have used it in different ways in different things I've written. So I confess.
Mm-hmm. So the Bodhisattva vow seems like that is often used as the whole.
Yeah, I think well, Bodhisattva actually, ethical restraints or Bodhisattva ethical code. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Because they are ethical restraints. What you're doing is saying, I'm making a decision to restrain from that. Yeah? Okay. But this is why the Sojung practice, you know, going to Sojung is so important. Okay, because you can't purify the offense without doing that. Okay, so if I remember correctly, we did the transmission for the virtuous karma and its effects, and now we're at explaining other kinds of karma. Yeah? Okay. So the karma that propels you into a happy rebirth is virtuous. The karma that propels you into a bad rebirth is non-virtuous. Although this is certain, the completing karma is uncertain, and it is taught that four combinations exist. Okay, so this is what comes next. These four are a review of what we talked about last week. The way it was explained was very confusing in the, you know, in the Gomchen Lamrim translation, so I kind of changed it a bit. Okay, so what is done intentionally and accumulated is karma whose effects must be experienced. So that's definite or certain karma. Okay. The opposite, in other words, it's neither done nor accumulated, is karma whose effects are not certain to be experienced. Okay? So something that you didn't do, nor did you have the intention to do. Okay? Then karma that is done, that is done physically or verbally. So karma is considered done, or maybe we should say the meaning of done, in done and accumulated, is karma that is done physically or verbally upon reflection, which motivates it. So there's an intention. And then that's what makes karma a karma that's done. And then accumulated karma is posited to be almost all of the rest. Once the 10, what is done in dreams and so forth, has been excluded. So we went through those 10 last time. Okay? And then non-accumulated karma are those 10. Doing it in a dream, somebody forcing you to do it. What was that? Were the other examples? Doing it unknowingly, unconsciously.
Having regret
right afterwards. Without doing purification. What are the other ones? Yeah, that's the purification, not applying the remedies, the four opponent powers. Okay. And then things that are done but not accumulated would be like somebody forcing you to do something. Yeah, you had no intention to do it. I don't know. Does that fall? I don't have the list of 10 out. Does coerced, like being coerced into something, is it one of the 10 or not?
Yes.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so
against
done.
Against your will.
Yeah, against your will. Okay. So that, yeah, so that's not done and not accumulated. Okay? Yeah, those four, always get to, yeah? And also because there's so many different ways of translating them. Definite and certain and then done and accumulated and some say, you know, performed and accomplished and intended, and so it's, you have to settle on one set of vocabulary words and stick to that.
I had a question about these two that came up. Shantideva, I can't remember exactly what he says, but he says something like it's known that someone who intends to give something and then doesn't has a terrible rebirth, right?
Yeah.
So I was trying to think, when I came up with that, I was like, okay, now that is intended but not done, or...
Well, it's intended, but it's in... The not doing it is intended and done.
So the not doing it is the intention.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you intend to give somebody to make an offering, and then you decide against it. So that decision not to do it is the intention. Uh-huh. And then keeping the offering for yourself is the done part of it.
But if you intend to do it and then you forgot that you intended to do it, it sort of falls into this... absent-minded.
Yeah, I think things, yeah, forgetfulness is one of the 10. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Wrote two more. Uh-huh. Actions that are ethically neutral, actions done without intensity or continuously.
Okay, so actions that are ethically neutral, okay, and actions that are not done intentionally.
Without intensity.
Without intensity, yeah. Or not continuously. Okay. So very weak actions, basically. Yeah. But then it's interesting, because if you, you know, like the commander of an army has the intention to kill different people, doesn't kill them themselves, but gets the same karma as if he He had killed them himself. So.
He gives the command to kill. I mean, he gives the direction.
Right. Yeah, because he gave the order to do it. So in a similar way, when we encourage other people to create virtue, then, you know, we get a share of it. But they also say when, you know, sometimes you may think, oh, well, I don't feel like making offerings, so I'll just tell somebody else to do it, you know. And they always say, no, when you have the opportunity yourself, you should definitely do it yourself with your own two hands. You ask somebody else to do it when you're unable to give it, you know. Like when somebody's going to Bodh Gaya or for the teachings in the South, we give offerings and ask that person to make them on our behalves. Okay?
Is it great good karma to have someone do it for you if that's your intention to help them?
Yeah. If you're trying to steer them to create virtue, then yeah, it's very good to do that. I had to do that. I think I mentioned to you once before that when I was in Singapore, there was one young man with a brain tumor who was dying. And Rinpoche wrote to Rinpoche and asked for practices for him to do and came back with a list. And the only way he would do them is if I did them with him. So I had to say, I want to go liberate animals. Will you drive me? You know? And that way he got involved in liberating the animals. Yeah.
You got extra merit from helping.
Yeah. Well, you have to do interesting things sometimes to get people to do stuff. Okay. Then there's a topic called the causes of full maturation. Okay. Okay. So what these... No, wait a minute. We have to go to the beginning of this. Okay. Where were we? Yes, see? Okay. So the karma whose effects must be experienced, the definite karma, from the angle of when they are experienced are called visible phenomena. In other words, those that are experienced in this life that are definite to ripen in this life, and those are actions that are especially strong. Okay. And then effects experienced after rebirth, those that are experienced in the next following life, so those are not quite as strong. And then, but it to be experienced in this life, it has to be really super strong. Yeah. And then those experienced at another time means those that experience not in the next life, but at some lifetime after that. Okay. Okay, then contemplating karma and its effects in particular. So it has three outlines, the advantages of full maturations, their junctions. I think it should be functions. Yeah. and then the causes of full maturations. Okay, so the first one, the advantages of favorable conditions. So it says the advantages of favorable conditions, their functions, and the causes of full maturations. With these, you achieve an excellent basis that leads to omniscience. So they concern eight things, okay? So there's what I put in is there's how they were translated in the copy we get and how they I found another translation of them. So they concern lifespan, which means long life, color, which means having an attractive, healthy body, lineage, means coming from a reputable family, wealth and reputation, that's obvious, trustworthy speech is, you know, you're credible, your speech can be trusted, great power means having strong influence on others, maleness means having willpower and being intrepid, and I will say more about that in a minute. And the eighth one is having strength, which means having a strong body and mind. Okay? So these are eight conditions, yeah, that they say if in addition to the eight freedoms and 10 fortunes, if you have these, it gives you an especially good opportunity to do very strong Dharma practice, you know, and to benefit a lot of beings. Now, having said that, when you look at them, some people who benefit a lot of beings and practice the Dharma well don't have all eight. Yeah, so it's just saying the more of these that you get, the better it is, okay? So, for example, His Holiness did not come from a wealthy family. Yeah, he came from a very poor family. Yeah, and then, you know, other people may not have a long life, but while they have a long life, they do a lot of good. Or some people may not have really good health or may not be especially attractive, but they're still able, they still do strong Dharma practice. So it's just saying with these eight that the more of them you have, the better it is in terms of, you know, having opportunity to practice and to benefit others. Now, the one about maleness, His Holiness says about that one, that you can see that that applies to a society. He talks about this often, how in ancient society, strength meant, you know, having power or strength or influence depended on your physical size, you know. But as civilization is, you know, more advanced now, at least in terms of technology and so on, physical size and physical strength isn't what is required to be, you know, prominent or to do certain things. So he was saying that, you know, this one came, the one of maleness, came about in a certain cultural context. But what's interesting is as we go into their functions and the causes, you'll see that there's a lot of gender discrimination lying behind it, nevertheless. But His Holiness explains it not in terms of gender discrimination, but just in terms of, you know, in olden societies, you needed to be able to knock somebody out to protect them, you know, from killing you. And so you needed to be able to wrestle with the tigers and, you know, these kinds of things. And so big men could do that better than women, so let them do it. You know, but now in the way our society is, that isn't so important to have, okay? So now the functions, you know, why these things are favorable conditions. So if you have a long life, it enables you to have a long time to accumulate virtue and to keep your precepts and to be a benefit. So that's that, you know, that's the reason for having long life. If we pray to have a long life, but we don't use our life to create virtue, then there's no sense in having a long life. Okay, so having a long life is only meaningful, you know, so that we have the opportunity to create virtue. Otherwise, if you have a long life and you use it to, you know, help your friends and harm your enemies and traumatize people and so on, then that, you know, you wind up with more negative karma at the end of the day. So not so valuable. Then having an attractive, healthy body, it says here, you know, the function is to tame disciples. You know, I'm not sure that people's minds get tamed by looking at an attractive person, but maybe it's the opposite, you know. But I think what it means is that if you're attractive, then people are drawn to you, and so that makes it easier for you to teach them the Dharma and to help them. And clearly, if you have a healthy body, You know, it makes Dharma practice easier. Although, if you, when you're sick, because you don't have a healthy body, if you think in the right way, you can be doing very strong purification. Okay, so you have to see these things have a lot of different factors, you know, involved in them. Then coming from a reputable family, yeah, the benefit is that people will apply your instructions. Yeah. So in general, in society, people look to families, people look to people with high status. I mean, especially in ancient India where you had the caste system, you know, if you didn't have a high caste, you might be brilliant up, down, and across, but nobody listened to you. Yeah? So coming from a reputable family gives you that kind of automatic respect from society in general. Now, to what extent that holds now, I don't know. Yeah? If a Kennedy says it, if a Rockefeller says it, you know, some people may listen, may pay more attention if a, you know, a Rockefeller or a, who are the other families? Bush families or Clintons or, you know, they may have more, listen more if it comes from a person like that. So some people are like that, but not everybody.
Such a person these days would make the press, would get some.
Yeah.
Would be heard in that.
Okay, so somebody like that would be in the press, more likely to be in the press, so they could get known. So you can see that a quality like this, you know, if you're practicing the Dharma and you can get in the press and advertise your virtues, not for the sake of your own reputation, but to encourage other people, that's good. But if you get in the press and all you're doing is advertising your bigotry and racism and exclusiveness and, you know, rudeness and imbecility. Is that a word, imbecility? Yeah? Then, you know, it doesn't have much meaning, does it? Yeah, okay. Then the fourth one is having wealth and reputation. So this means yourself being wealth and, you know, having a good reputation. So it means you can draw in sentient beings. So that is true. You know, if somebody's rich, if somebody has a good reputation, people are more attracted to them if somebody's famous. But on the other hand, you have to see what somebody is famous for, you know. I mean, if Lady Gaga used her fame to encourage virtue, yeah, then it would be one thing. If one of our dear friends used all of his wealth that he brags about so much in a philanthropic way, you know, and gives it to the refugees who have nothing so that they can have schools and a good livelihood, then having that wealth and reputation would be really useful. Yeah. But if you just keep it all to yourself and boast about it, it, you know, you create negative karma with it. So you see with all of these, it isn't the having of the thing itself that's so important, it's how you use it. Yeah? Okay, then the fifth one is trustworthy speech. So this one, I think, is quite important. So the function of this is assembling, you know, the four means of assembling disciples, okay? So not all four involve speech, but most of them do. And trustworthy speech, do you see how often this comes up? You know, in Precious Garland, continuously he's bringing it up. You know, this text also continuously. How important our speech is. Yeah? Okay, and this one I think is quite important. You know, even if you're not so attractive, even if you don't have a long life and a healthy body and a reputable family and, you know, all these other things, if you have trustworthy speech, you can have a lot of influence and do a lot of good. Yeah, can't you? Because we see in society now, you know, even people may come from a very low status family. I mean, like His Holiness, yeah. And I mean, he just came from a poor family. I don't know if you call it low status, but you know, look what he did with this life. Or Upali, you know, the monk Upali, who was the one who recited the Vinaya at the first council. He was from the barber class, right? And so, you know, hold on to your teeth. But, you know, that was considered a very low class. But the Sakya, there were some Sakyas who were taking ordination at the same time as him. So they had him ordained first so that it would help them tame their own arrogance. And you could look at what he did. He came from a low class, yeah. But he was the one who recited the Vinaya. So, you know, he was pretty good. Then the sixth one is having a strong influence on others. Okay, so it says great power, but strong influence on others. So the benefit of that is that then what you do is acknowledged and, you know, people follow your instructions. So this is the one I don't have. Yeah. Yeah. Even the cats don't listen to me. You know, nobody around here listens to me. So, And, okay, but you can see if you're somebody who's able to have strong influence on others, you know, then, but how do you get that? You know, sometimes the other things are what give you the strong influence.
Guarding against the four verbal numbers.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Being a nice person probably would help. Okay, then seven. You know, maleness, what this means is having willpower and being intrepid, okay? And it says that allows for vast wisdom and no obstacles, okay? So I don't see how having a male sex organ enables you to have vast wisdom without obstacles. You know, in and of itself... That doesn't make any sense, does it? You know?
This is going to go viral.
What?
This is
going to
go viral.
Okay. Okay. But one example they do use is if you want to go on solitary retreat out in the mountains, a man can do that with greater ease than a woman can. And I remembered Venerable Tarpa was very... you know, she didn't like that one bit at all. She protested a lot. And, you know, yes, men can be raped as well as women can be raped. It does happen that usually women are raped more often because of the way society is, you know, and we may be easier to overpower. Yeah. But aside from those kind of situations, you know, I don't think it really makes much difference. Okay.
What?
Yes?
One obvious advantage to being male is not having to deal with the sexism that women have to deal with.
Yes. Okay. So?
And these are, this is coming off as sexist.
Yeah, it is coming off as sexist, isn't it?
These are cultures that, and it's still... true
in this culture. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah,
very
I mean...
true in the cultures that this was written in.
Yeah. I mean, it's true in ancient India, and even now, you know, if women, as soon as a lot of women do a certain career, the pay in that career goes down, and for every dollar a man gets paid, women make, what is it, like 70 cents, something doing the same work. So, okay, maybe one advantage is not having to deal with all that. But then when you think about it, you know, who do we have in terms of committing crimes and fighting wars? who does that more, women or men?
Men.
Yeah. Men do it much more. Yeah. And the prison system, you know, full of men, the percentage of women is very, very low. I remember one time, this was many years ago, I was talking with another woman. We were talking to one of the young Geshe's and, you know, asking about this. And he said, well, yeah, you know, if somebody comes and starts beating you up, a man's going to fight back, you know, because he's more powerful. And a woman's just going to run away. And we said, yeah, that's because we're smart. You know, we don't want to get beaten up. We don't want to start a war, you know. So it's very interesting how you look at what strength is. Yeah.
Venerable, I do think that the conditioning of being a woman is so deeply pervasive in how we cater. I mean, I see this myself all the time.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect of it that just because of the way the societies are.
Yeah. So it's the way the society is and the way you're conditioned that may have some adverse, you know, things. But those are things that we can't overcome what society thinks, but the most important thing is to overcome our own conditioning. Yeah. Yeah, because if you can't overcome your own conditioning, then you're really stuck, okay? Okay, so you have to have willpower and be intrepid, okay? And then having a powerful body and mind brings great enthusiasm and the quick attainment of supernormal powers. So I think what it means there, having a strong body and mind, is that you can develop serenity without difficulty. You know, you can really put yourself in a retreat situation and do it and develop the powers through serenity. Okay, then the causes of them, okay, so the causes of long life is not harming sentient beings. So that makes sense, or saving life, okay? The cause of having an attractive, healthy body, offering butter lamps and so forth, things like new clothes. Now that's an interesting one. Usually they say offering light is the cause of wisdom, not for an attractive, healthy body. Here it's for attractive, healthy. And then offering new clothes. Yes, new clothes make you more attractive. But, you know, these are not the only things. These are kind of, like, remember when we were talking in Precious Garland about the causes of the 32 signs of the Buddha? Those were more specific causes. There's also the general causes. And if you don't have the general causes, you can offer all the new clothes you want, but you're not going to have, you know, an attractive, healthy body.
Patience
also, you know, practicing fortitude, overcoming anger is often given as that cause. Then a reputable family is having that condition is to overcome pride. But here you can see the difference, you know, if you overcome pride, to be born in a respectful family, a reputable family. If you have a lot of pride, then it's the cause to be born in a lowly rebirth, okay? And of course, that goes up and down each lifetime, doesn't it? Yeah? And so you see, I mean, people, if you see different classes in society, people who are in the lower class this life, you know, but who accept it gracefully and, you know, abandon arrogance and anger and resentment, in a future life, they'll be born as the people, you know, in a higher position. If the people in the higher position act with condescension and arrogance, then next life, they get born as the lowly people. So it can go up and down and up and down. You know, you're not sure who's master and who's slave, because it changes lifetime to lifetime. Yeah. Actually, we shouldn't have any masters or slaves, but you know how that happens. Okay, then wealth and reputation. Then it's giving food, clothing, and so forth when requested. Yeah, giving food is often a cause for concentration, to gain concentration too. Yeah. But, you know, you can see how it fits with wealth and reputation. And then for trustworthy speech, the cause is familiarization with abstention from the four verbal non-virtues, so that makes sense. For having a strong influence on others, the cause is making aspirational prayers and making offerings to the gurus and the three jewels. Okay? But making aspirational prayers, that could bring you all sorts of different things, depending on what you're aspiring for. Maybe that's the meaning here, that you're aspiring to have a strong influence on others. Okay? And then having willpower and being intrepid. And here's where you have the sexism. Reflecting on the disadvantages of femaleness and saving beings from castration. So this is one reason that the monasteries, that they don't neuter the dogs.
No.
Yeah. Because they think that something, you know, there's something non-virtuous about it and it may, you know, adversely affect you. Yeah. No, they don't neuter any of the animals. And remember in Australia, somebody in a break time asked His Holiness that question. And he kind of gave, well, it depends on the circumstances and, you know, that kind of answer. Yeah. Okay. But then also, if you think that in ancient India there were eunuchs, yeah, and to save somebody from being a eunuch was probably a good thing. Okay, then to have a strong body and mind, then the cause is helping in whatever way is suitable and providing food and drink. Okay. So again, what we see here is different causes can apply to more than one result, and different results in different contexts have different causes. Okay? So I think it also depends on what is in your mind. You know, when you're doing something, for what reason you're doing it. Okay, then it says, if the eight have the three, the favorable conditions will be excellent. Okay, so the three are pure attitude, pure practice, and pure field or pure recipients. Okay, so for pure attitude, in relationship to you, yourself, and in relationship to others. And in relationship to yourself, there's two parts of having a pure attitude. So one is dedicating the merit to awakening the virtuous causes that you produce, so how you dedicate your merit. Yeah, and that you're dedicating your merit for something good, not wasting it. And another part is producing these causes from the depth of your heart. Yeah, so creating virtue and then dedicating it properly, yeah, is a pure attitude in relationship to yourself. In relationship to others, the pure attitude is when you see someone in harmony with the teachings, giving up rivalry and instead rejoicing. So don't compete with other Dharma practitioners. Yeah, that I want to be closer to the teacher, I want to be recognized, I want to do this and that, you know, more recognition, more, you know, authority, more voice and decisions, you know. I mean, people can compete on all sorts of things. So the proper attitude is instead to rejoice at others' virtues and not compete with them. And then second part of that is, even if you can't do what that person can do, still having the wish to be able to do it. Okay, so instead of being jealous of the other person, you know, try and do it yourself, and if you can't, still have the wish to have that quality. You know, and then that way you're setting the seeds in your own mind to have certain qualities in the future. Then for pure practice, these are often also expressed in relation to yourself and in relationship to others. So the first, in relationship to yourself, is long-term, intense, and uninterrupted practice. Okay, so you can see why that's pure practice in relationship to yourself. And the second, in relationship to others, is to incite or encourage those who have yet to engage in virtue to do so, to praise those who have done so, to gladden them, and to ensure that they will continue and do not give up. So basically encouraging other people to create virtue, praise them what they do. And this is a very nice practice. You know, when you do this, it really changes your mind when you make it part of your daily practice to encourage people and to point out other people's good qualities, either to themselves or to other people. It really changes your mind in a very good way, because we're so used to picking at other people's faults. But when we can look at somebody and say, oh, they do this really well, or, you know, they did a good job at this, whether we say it to them or say it to other people, it's very good. It's a very good practice. And then for pure field, what that means is that the attitude and practice are like a field that yields an abundant and excellent harvest. Okay, so if we practice the first two, we create a big harvest of merit and good results. Yeah, so you can see, you know, that including these, especially like the pure attitude, yeah, is very important to have those eight circumstances be something that help you create virtue and help you along the path. Otherwise, if you don't have that pure attitude, you're born in a reputable family, but you're arrogant. You have wealth, but you're selfish and miserly. You know, you're born as a male and you discriminate against other people and put them down. So, you know, you have to have a pure attitude and a pure practice. Okay. So, any questions about this?
How do you understand, these are supposed to be stated in the sutras?
These are supposed to be?
These points are supposed to be stated
in the sutra, right.
And then, like, when you explain the maleness and all, and how His Holiness explains it, then, are we saying, what the sutra is saying is not correct in our context?
I think that's what His Holiness is trying to say, in explaining the one about maleness, because he's putting it in the context of certain societies, you know, where strength, physical strength is most important, and then saying, now in our society, this is not so important, you know, having intelligence is more important, having compassion is more important, yeah. So I think also what's said in the sutras, it's also said in a certain cultural context. Yeah, things like that. I mean, there's certain things in the sutras, of course, you know, like the 10 non-virtuous, forget the cultural context. They're going to be non-virtuous. But then other kind of attitudes or practices or actions, you know, it depends on the culture. It isn't, you know, one size fits all the time. Yeah, I think that's important to remember, especially about this, the whole gender discrimination thing, you know, that it's really taught in that context. And we still have gender discrimination in our world. But having gender discrimination does not mean that women are inferior, just as having racism does not mean that African Americans are inferior. Okay? So we have to be very clear about that kind of thing. Yeah? Because when you're on the side of the majority, yes, of course, you know, I'm white, yeah, You know, being black doesn't mean that you're inferior. But if you grow up in that family with that kind of conditioning, you may adopt that conditioning, even though it's false. Okay? So that's the hindrance, is assuming the negative conditioning ourselves. You know, and of course, you still have to do something with structural injustice in society and societal prejudice. You know, you still have to do that. But the point is, just because somebody is prejudiced against you doesn't mean you're inferior. That's the point of it. Yeah. So whether it's racism or sexism or ageism or, you know, any of the isms, whatever it is, you know, just because some people have bias and are prejudiced doesn't mean that the other group is inferior. Yeah, it's more a reflection of the majority group's mentality, isn't it? Than it is a reflection of the people they're prejudiced about. No, they just go ahead with this. In the monasteries, they're all men, so they can say whatever they want about women. Nobody corrects them. And they're not sensitive to that kind of thing because they don't have a lot of interaction with women. Yeah. So His Holiness, of course, corrects it. Yeah. But aside from that, in the monasteries, I don't think they do that very much.
Because I felt like when they say it, and then I question, because the sutra says so.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of these things, I think, came afterwards. They were put in. I mean, I know definitely one thing in one of the ordination ceremonies that is discriminatory against women was put in later, you know. So it's very possible that some of these things came in later. And some historians say, because in ancient India, there was... What was it? Manu? Yeah, somebody named Manu who made all these edicts and social policies, and a lot of them were very discriminatory towards women. But, you know, they got absorbed in Buddhist thinking because that was prevalent in that society at that time. She's saying, what about kitties? Yeah. We have to be on a leash when we go outside. You're prejudiced against us.
I'm trying to save them from creating bad karma.
Yes, we are, aren't we? But they don't understand how we're trying to help them.
Well, yeah. A question on mind, isn't mental strength more relevant to developing the mind than physical?
Of course, mental strength is more relevant to developing the mind. If you don't have any mental strength, you can't do anything. You know, then you wind up like, you know, then you wind up being a big, strong playground bully. Yeah, with no mental strength to use in an intelligent way, but you just threaten people.
And then look at Stephen Hawkins, who has no physical...
Right. Well, that's a very good example. Look at Stephen Hawkins, who, you know, is paraplegic and can't speak either, can he? And yet he's brilliant, and people have high regard for him and listen to him. Yeah. Even though there's, you know, talk about discrimination, there's a lot against, I don't know the correct term now, other abled people. Yeah.
They say differently abled.
Differently abled people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of discrimination. And yet, Stephen Hawkins, you know, my goodness. Okay.